Atha Nityam Anityam Va Neha Shochanti Tadvidaha Nanyatha Shakyate Kartu Sabhava Shochatami. Prabhupada's translation. Those who have full knowledge of self-realization, who know very well that the spirit soul is eternal, whereas the body is perishable, are not overwhelmed by lamentation. But persons who lack knowledge of self-realization certainly lament. Therefore, it is difficult to educate a person in illusion. Prabhupada's purport. According to the Mimamsa philosophers, everything is eternal, nitya, and according to the Sankhya philosophers, everything is mithya, or anitya, impermanent. Nonetheless, without real knowledge of Atma, the soul, such philosophers must be bewildered and must continue to lament as Shudras. Srila Sukadeva Goswami therefore said to Parikshit Maharaj, Shrotavyadini Rajendra Ninang Santi Sahasra Shahar Apashyatam Atma Tattvam Griheshu Grihamedinam. Famous verse. Those who are materially engrossed, being blind to knowledge of the ultimate truth, have many subjects for hearing in human society, O Emperor. For ordinary persons engaged in material activities, there are many, many subject matters to understand because such persons do not understand self-realization. One must therefore be educated in self-realization so that under any circumstances in life, he will remain steady in his vows. Prabhupada ki jai. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swamini Dinamini. Namaste Sarasate Deve Gauravani Pracharini Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschati Deshacharini. Atha Nityam Anityam Va Neha Shochanti Tad Vidaha Nanyatha Shakyate Karatum Subhava Shochatamiti. So, Tad Vidaha, those who understand these things, Shochanti, na iha shochanti, they do not in this world lament, for nityam, that which is permanent, or anityam, impermanent. And of course the verse begins with the word atta, therefore, and so obviously refers back to the previous verse. Which, just to remind you, I'll read again. Vitata vinivesho yam. Yadgune sharta drig bachaha. People absorbed in things that are not really the truth speak and see meaning in the material modes of nature just as an illusory dream, and actually in which everything simply comes from the sense of sense perception and is illusory. So therefore, because of that, I mean, one who understands that, for example, if you go to buy a car and you spend a lot of money, maybe 20,000 euros, and then they give you a little movie of a car and you can go home and watch a movie of a car. And the point is, it's not a real car. So, the idea is that someone, or let's say there's some what is called fool's gold. I don't know, you know, French or Dutch or whatever, how you say it, but you have that term? Fool's gold? Huh? It looks like gold, but it's not really gold. So in English they call it fool's gold. Gold for fools. So the material world is something like that. It's closer. Okay. My manager wants me to put the microphone closer. Hare Krishna, it's better? So, this whole material world is something like fool's gold. So, And just to complete what this verse says, Nanyata Shakyate Kartum Subhava Shochitamiti. People in knowledge, the word iti in Sanskrit is something like quotation marks. So when iti follows a phrase, it means the words preceding the word iti are a direct quotation. That's what someone is thinking, or that's what someone is saying to themselves or to others. So here, Nanyata Shakyate Kartum Subhava Shochatam Iti means that those who have knowledge do not lament or grieve over the permanent or impermanent because they're thinking or they know what is in the last two lines of this verse. Namely, that Subhava, one's own nature or nature itself or the nature of things themselves. For example, if you buy a computer, then you know that it must eventually break down, or a car, or a body. If we have, those of us who have material bodies, I'm speaking to those of you in the room who are not ghosts, those who actually have material bodies, we know the body must get old and must eventually die. That's just the way it is. It's called swabhava. Swa means one's own. German sein and French son, and Spanish su, and so on. That's all the Sanskrit swa. So, svabhava, that's the nature, that's its own existence, is like that. It's svabhava. And nanyata shakyate kartum, it is not possible. Shakyate, the passive form of the verb shak, to be able to do something, is used in the sense of to be possible, like something is able to be done. So na anyata. I was speaking yesterday about yata tata. Here we have anyata, otherwise, in another way. It is not possible nashakite to for it to act, or it's not possible to act upon it in another way. That's because that's just the way it is. And shochitam of those lamenting. So the whole idea here, just like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. Tasmat parihariyarte natam shochitum arhasi, to Arjuna. You should not lament for that which is beyond your control. And the word Krishna uses here, beyond your control, is apariharya. Pari in Sanskrit, of course, is Greek peri, like perimeter, periscope, etc. It means around. Pari and harya, to be taken or to be removed. In other words, there's no way to get rid of it. There's no way to get rid of it. Pari in Sanskrit as a prefix often means like completely or entirely. So there is simply no way to get around it. There's no way to remove it. And so Krishna says, arte, in a matter, in a purpose or in some situation in which it simply cannot be removed in any way, cannot be avoided, you should not lament. And here the same idea is given, that nanyata shakyate kartam, it's simply not possible to do anything else with it. Or it's not possible for it to do anything else. For example, you can pray to your material body and say, please don't die. But the body has its nature. The body can't do anything else. And the people have their nature. So some people, they're like, it's like a car with a broken axle. That they just, you drive the car, it's just going to go off the road. Just like, for example, some people are, they find themselves as victims. It's like, I remember when I was in Brazil, tropical country, I was on the farm there, and so in the summer especially, there's like trillions at least of insects. And there's one kind of beetle that it has a very short life, and when I woke up in the morning, you'd see all these beetles lying on their backs, something like Kafka, you know, the Metamorphosis. These beetles are on their backs at the end of their life, wiggling their legs. And so when I first saw this, I thought, well, I'll help them, their spirit soul. So I would take these beetles and put them back on their feet, and they would take three steps and go and flip over on their backs again. Some people are like that. So therefore, I mean, I've had to, in my own, I guess I'm a, well, not, I don't really think I'm a priest or anything, but I have, I guess, a religious vocation. But when I, some people want help and some people want attention. The people that want attention don't really want help, they just want attention. So So that's the idea. We have to see the actual nature of things. We have to see the nature of things, and those who are lamenting, they're lamenting because they just cannot accept reality. That, and of course, we have that problem. All of us have that problem. We just cannot accept reality when we are too attached to something. We are simply too attached. And so, okay, it's like this, but I don't want it to be like that. This person doesn't love me, but this person has to love me. I can't live if this person doesn't love me. That really sounds like a bad movie, doesn't it? Actually, sometimes in our mind, we have all these really bad movies going on. If you actually put them out on the screen, people would say, that's really a bad movie. So that's what lamentation is. We lament because we don't understand that there's actually someone much more intelligent than we are who's flying the plane. And so Krishna actually knows what he's doing. He's very intelligent. It's one of his opulences. And of course, we have our own plans and desires. We become attached. We have these material bodies. And the bodies are just wired in such a way that when they see something which is attractive to the body just fastens up, you know, mentally just becomes attached to it. Because we have particular, you've seen those, I don't know if you've seen those old Terminator movies. When the Terminator first comes down, and he's usually, for some reason, people in the future have the technology to send robots back in time, but not closed. Which is never really explained. It doesn't seem like it would be more difficult to send a robot than to send clothes. Or, I mean, it would be more difficult to send clothes. Somehow or other, they had not mastered the art of sending clothes back in time. So when the Terminator first arrives, he has to find someone that has the same size clothes he does. And so you see his computer mind looking for a match. And so we're like that because our bodies are just these sort of these mode machines. They're just composed of the modes. So we like a particular kind of food or fragrance or other people. Like we say, oh, that person's just my type. Or we really get along. We really are meant for each other. Or I really like this place or that color or whatever. These are just mode matches. And because our body is composed of these modes of nature, and when there's a match, the mind is locked onto it. You know, it's a mode match. You've got a mode match. And then and this, of course, is true for the mind and the body. And then it depends on how strongly attached we are to these objects. And as a point I've made many, many times, there is philosophical atheism, but there's also psychological atheism. One may philosophically believe in God, but psychologically or emotionally be very self-centered and think oneself to be the enjoyer. So just to be merely a philosophical theist is like jnana, but vijnana means you've actually accepted it, not just as an idea or as a correct idea, but you really see the world that way and you feel things that way. You really feel that you're a servant of Krishna. So anyway, those who have knowledge, they understand these things. And of course, it's easier said than done. Also a popular song in the 60s by a group called the Essex. But anyway, so it's easier said than done. But that's what it means to have knowledge in Krishna consciousness. Anityam, anityam va. Prabhupada explains that he quotes this verse, Shrotavyadini Rajendra, from the second canto of the Bhagavatam. So how do we come to this platform? Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that Vishaya Vinivartante Niraha Rasya Dehina. If we simply by mechanical processes, Krishna gives the example of fasting, nirahara. Ahara means food or eating. And so nirahara, one who's fasting. And Krishna says, Vishaya Vinivartante. I just like you know the Nivritti Marg means where you give up. There's Pravritti Marg and Nivritti Marg. There's Pravritti means proceeding and Nivritti means receding. We're going back. Pravartate, Nivartate. One little linguistic note, just for your amusement. Because Sanskrit is, of course, English is an Indo-European language. So in Sanskrit, you have these verbal stems like vart. So you can have, and then you add prefixes to change the meaning, like pra vartate, ni vartate, sang vartate, avi vartate, anu vartate, a vartate, and so on. And we still have it in English, actually, that same structure. And we still have the stem vart, actually, which was just in a very tiny, tiny way changed in English, the vowel to vert, as in revert, pervert, invert, subvert, and so on. So you see the connection between English and Sanskrit is not simply that some words sound the same, like if you're addressing your mother in Sanskrit, you actually do not say Mataji. You say Mater. Also, actually, in the Bhagavatam, it's very hard to find a case where someone calls a woman that is not their mother, mother. But that's another point. So, anyway, Krishna says, Vishaya vinivartante. So, nivart, or like nivritti, means to recede instead of proceed, to go away from something. And so, and vinivartante has a sense of sort of categorically, or also emphasizes the point of really pulling away. So the idea here is if you don't eat, if you actually keep fasting, you will eventually not feel material lust. In fact, you will not feel anything. You'll just be like that. So what Krishna is saying is that if you just give up the sense objects or fast, which is, has always been a monastic strategy, if you look at the history of monasticism, you know, Buddhism or Christianity, that if a monk is getting too romantic or too lusty, then, you know, don't feed him. So this is what Krishna says, Vishaya vinivartante niraha rasya dehinam, among embodied beings, but rasavarjam, the senses go away, the sense objects, vishaya, the sense objects go away, but not the real taste for it. Because, for example, one can just fast, and then I don't feel lust anymore, but, you know, one good feast, and the person, you know, the lust comes roaring back. That's all it takes is one good meal, and you're back in the same situation. So, vishaya vinivartante niraha rasya dehinam rasa varjan. But then Krishna says, rasopyasya, but even the rasa, even the taste, param drishtva nivartate, goes away when we literally see something higher, which we is often translated higher taste. Parang drishtva, seeing something. And this is something which Krishna emphasizes in the Gita, the need to actually see the truth. For example, in that famous verse, tad vidhi pranipatena, which literally just means know this. And it's translated learn the truth, know this. Of course, Krishna is talking about knowledge or truth. Tadvidhi, know this, pranipatena. Pata means falling, actually. And nipata means sort of like falling down, and pra, sort of like forward. So it's, so pranipata is literally the motion of going like that. And so it's, which of course is translated submission, or by surrendering to or submitting to. So tadvidhi, pranipatena, pari prasnena. Again, pari, around. Which in Sanskrit is often used to mean something like completely or fully. In other words, all around. So, and prashna's question. Pari prasnena, by full inquiries. What is pari prasna? It doesn't mean, like, I remember I've had some disciples that think it's their duty to me to send me lots of letters asking me lots of trivial questions, and then they sometimes apologize if they were busy and weren't able to do that. But actually, pari prasna, or full questions, means what you need to know to be fixed in Krishna consciousness. Not just the guru is not just a, it's sort of like to help you win the next Vedic trivia contest. Or just because, I was always curious about that. So It's but what do you really need to know in order to be strong in Krishna consciousness? There's some serious doubt or some serious misunderstanding that's preventing you from advancing in Krishna consciousness, then one has to ask. And so you can see why this is given as a duty, because we may have a doubt and not question. We may actually not want to know the answer. Sometimes a doubt can be a good justification not to fully surrender. So sometimes psychologically we may actually avoid clearing everything up, or because we're afraid we may not like the answer, or somehow the answer is not flattering to us. But that is a duty. Pranipatena, pariprasnena, sevaya, and by service. And then Krishna says, upadekshanti te jnanam. They, it's in the plural. They will instruct you. This upadekshanti is the word upadesha, like upadeshamrita, instruction. But this is the third person plural future of the verb. They will instruct. Upadekshanti te jnanam. They will teach you knowledge, jnaninas, those who have knowledge. Krishna has put these two words together. It's very interesting. Upadekshanti te jnanam, jnaninas. That is intentional. That wasn't just an accident. The two words happen to go together. If you read the Bhagavad Gita carefully, you can see what Krishna is doing in the Sanskrit. Jnanam, jnaninas. He's making a very simple but very powerful point. Those who have knowledge will teach knowledge. Meaning those who don't have it can't teach it. So upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninas, and those who are tattva darshina, those who have seen tattva. Krishna, seers of the truth, I think it's translated, those who have seen the truth. So there are different words for truth in Sanskrit, such as ritam, satyam, tattvam, and so on, that have different shades of meaning. Satyam is sort of like tell the truth, don't lie. That's satyam. What is really true? Tattva is a particular word for truth, which I'll explain. It's, for example, you know that verse, Vedanti tat, tattva vidas, tattvam yad jnanam, and so on. So Krishna, here and other places in the Gita, talks about those who are tattva darshi, or tattva darshina. The word tattva, first of all, comes from the word tat, which is English if you add an H, that, it's the same word. For some reason, people in English-speaking countries became attached to biting their tongues. So instead of saying tut, they said that. Anyway, tut means that. And twa is a suffix, which means something like English-ness, like thatness. And of course, thatness means that, like the state of being that. And so, what does that mean? Why is the word tat, that, such an important word? For example, om tat sat. The idea is that tat is a demonstrative pronoun, grammatically. In other words, it's, like in German, it would be das, das Auto. Or in German, French would be cette voiture. So it's just that. And so a demonstrative pronoun is something literally that demonstrates something, that points something out. So you can only point out a real thing. You can talk about things like a unicorn, although I suppose on some planet there must be unicorns, with Tilak, I guess. But actually, that, taken seriously, in the serious grammatical, philosophical sense of the word, that must mean a real thing, because you cannot demonstrate something that doesn't exist. Just like in science, if something is real, you have to demonstrate it. So therefore, tat comes to mean in Sanskrit, in philosophical Sanskrit, a real thing, a real object that can be actually demonstrated. And twa means having the status of being a real object. Tatvam. And it comes to mean in Sanskrit a categorical truth. A categorical truth. Not merely something which is true, like it's true that we're in Belgium right now, but a categorical truth, such as Vishnu Tattva, where Tattva means a real category, or a category of real things that exist. Vishnu Tattva, Jiva Tattva, Prakriti Tattva, and so on. And also in that verse, Vedanti tat tatva vidang tatvam yad jnanam advayam, that, for example, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, they are different categories of the Absolute Truth. And so therefore they're called tattvas. So interestingly, the verse, tadvidhi pranipatena, that know that truth by submission, full inquiry and service, the people who will teach us knowledge, the people who have knowledge, are specifically tattva darshina. They have seen tattva. And so to see tattva means that you've actually seen or deeply understood, see here in the sense of also deeply understood, the difference between the three tattva triads. There's a tattva triad means the three fundamental truths, which are nature, property, jiva, the soul, and Ishvara, God. And Krishna, in various ways, explains in the Gita, these are the three fundamental categories of real things. There is material nature, there is the jiva, and there is God. And so if you actually understand these three things, then you are tattva-darshi. If you deeply understand these three categories, then you are tattva-darshi. So these are distinctions. And a word for distinction in Sanskrit, a common word, is vishesha. Vishesha means a distinction. Therefore, visheshana means an adjective. Because an adjective distinguishes things. Like, let's say, the temple. Which temple? The big temple, the small temple, the white temple, the blue temple. And so adjectives, grammatically, distinguish things. They apply to a noun, and they distinguish it from other nouns of the same category. So, if you cannot make these distinctions, one who is not a tattva-darshi, for example, thinking the jiva is the body, is a confusing jiva and prakriti. Or thinking that Krishna has a material body is confusing Ishvara and prakriti. Or thinking that we are all God is confusing Ishvara and jiva. So, one who is confused in this way, one who cannot distinguish between the tattvas, is a person who is called nirvishesha. Someone who cannot make proper distinctions. And so therefore, in Prabhupada Pranam, unto nirvishesha shunyavadi. So the impersonalists are called nirvishesha in the sense that they cannot make the distinction between Ishvara and Jiva. And therefore, they're nirvishesha. So, seeing, Krishna often talks, do we have any Gitas here? Yes. Oh, no, I mean, thank you. No. Yeah, actually, I just published this book, which is a sort of a systematic explanation of the Bhagavad Gita based on the Sanskrit text. And we have a few copies. Unfortunately, we don't have many copies left. Oh, not now. Maybe later today. But you can see Chandrasekhar. And please have your credit card ready. But actually, one of the categories in the Gita, which is very important, is the category of seeing knowledge. Krishna, throughout the Gita, often uses this image of seeing knowledge. Just like in that phrase, param drishtvani vartate. Param drishtvani vartate, that one actually goes beyond illusion when one sees something higher. And you should get knowledge from those who have seen tattva and so on. So how do we get that higher realization? So that we become, as it is said here, tadvidaha. We join this elite club of those who have seen the truth, or those who actually understand Krishna consciousness. The Bhagavatam, of course, talks about that. It really basically comes down to once and for all really accepting that I'm not God. I mean, it is a crushing disappointment to find out, A, there is a God, and B, it's not me. I remember one time Prabhupada was giving a lecture, a morning class in Los Angeles, and he said what he'd said often, that so many people are praising me, giving me credit for having started this movement, especially in India. People were just absolutely astonished at what Prabhupada had done. So wherever he went, people were just heaping praise on him. And so Prabhupada was saying, I don't take the credit. Krishna has done it. Then he said, however, if you must give me some credit, you can say this. I never tried to take Krishna's position. And that's it's a simple statement, but Prabhupada is probably the only person on the planet that could say it. And actually could say it and have it be true. Because, I mean, which of us can say, I never try to enjoy this world. I never try to be the center of attention. I mean, who can say that? Only Prabhupada could say that. So really, the whole process of bhakti yoga is just gradually getting over your disappointment that you're not God. Like I said, it's devastating, but it's true. And so that's what this world is. It is sort of this very sophisticated mental institution. Where it's just like in a mental institution, you see all these people walking around babbling and talking, and everyone is in their own world, and everyone, you know, someone is Napoleon, someone is, I don't know, Queen Victoria or something. And so the same way, this world is really like that. It's like everyone is going around babbling, thinking that I'm the most important person. And it really is. And then the gurus, I guess, you know, Prabhupada, pure devotees come down, they're sort of like the doctors for the institution. You know, it's like someone goes up to the doctor in the mental institution and says, I'm Napoleon. The doctor says, no, actually you're not Napoleon. No, I am. No, you're really not. So that was like Prabhupada. You know, no, you're really not your body. So Prabhupada was so merciful, he came down here and just had to deal with all these mad people. And so, I mean, one phrase that Krishna uses in Bhagavad Gita is vigata jwara, that one has to be free of fever. There's something feverish, that anxiety that, you know, do you love me? Do you really love me? How come you didn't say you love me? And, you know, all these really bad movies. I mean, if we took the contents of our mind and put them on a screen, people would say, I want my money back for that. I don't want to watch this movie. I've seen this so many times. This is really bad acting. This is totally melodrama. So, anyway, that's the process of bhakti yoga. It's just the gradual process of becoming sane and waking up and realizing who we really are. And actually, it's not a bad thing to be part of Krishna. It has its rewards. And as they say, it's better to give than to receive. It's that real pleasure is loving. On the material platform, we think pleasure is being loved. But when we become pure, we realize pleasure is loving. It's actually a much higher taste. So, we'll leave a little time. Are there any questions on these points? Yes.
Thank you very much. You mentioned about the mode match.
Yes.
I was just wondering, but where is the line? Also, there's a personality. I mean, spiritually, we're persons.
Yes.
So if it's all mode match, then where's the personality? I mean,
well, in terms of, let's say, you find another person and you say we're just, you know, naturally meant to be friends or a couple or whatever. I mean, to what extent is it just, is it a mere mode match? And to what extent are there two souls that have a real affinity? That depends on how Krishna conscious a person is. It depends on what the active ingredient is in the attraction. As we know, arranged marriages right now are about as popular as poison food. And so now everyone, of course, just makes their own arrangement. The result is not, I mean, sometimes it works, a lot of times it doesn't work. Because, young people basically are, I don't want to say clinically insane, but they are, I mean, it's, their brains aren't even fully formed. For example, young people have much more automobile accidents. That's why they have to pay so much for car insurance, because they're a little crazy. When I was young, on the other hand, I was very crazy. And it really is a divine miracle that I'm still alive based on how I used to drive when I was a teenager. So young people, or for example, I just saw this article on how the prevalence, the proliferation of cell phones is changing, or perhaps the better word is destroying etiquette. So now people in situations where formerly you were expected to actually just be present and pay attention, now they're on their cell phone. For example, they did the study and they said, how many people think that it's okay if you're at, for, say, a family event, you know, families getting together, it's okay just to get on your cell phone. And a certain percentage thought it's okay, and then among young people, almost everybody thought it was okay. So there are certain things in life. I mean, basically, we learn about life by seeing causes and effects. Like, I ate this food, and then I couldn't sleep all night, and I felt miserable, and I had a stomachache, so maybe I won't eat that food again. Or we do things in the world, and we see what happens. And that's how we learn. But the fact is, there are some consequences that take longer to manifest. For example, if you accidentally touch something hot, the effect is immediate. It's immediate. And so you learn, don't touch hot things. But we do certain things, let's say you eat certain foods, the consequences may not manifest for 20 years or 30 years. Some consequences manifest in a year. For example, a teenager falls madly in love. I had my insane teenage pastimes. A teenager falls madly in love and then you know, ends up madly suffering. And then you realize all that glitters isn't gold. And so if a person is young, they just it's actually not possible for them to know certain things about life. Because the modern world is all based on sex, and because young people tend to be sexier than old people, somehow or other young people are now like, oh yeah, that's the way everyone should want to be. But actually, no. I mean, I'd rather have a brain than a body. I mean, in the sense that it's about wisdom. It's really about wisdom. And unless someone is, there are young people that just have this natural wisdom. You know, from past lives, they're mature, they have this natural wisdom, but not most of them. And so therefore, you know, people fall in love, or they want to do this, or they want to do that, and literally, there's no possible way they could know the consequences, because they haven't lived that long. But your original question was? Yes, mode match. So as far as the mode match, it depends. It depends on how Krishna conscious someone is. And it depends on what their modes are. For example, let's say someone's really in the mode of goodness, and there's like ding, 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 a mode match. So now, by definition, according to Bhagavad Gita, the mode of goodness is enlightening, which is Krishna's word, prakashakam. He says, sattvam nirmalatvat prakashakam. Sattva, goodness, because it's relatively pure, is enlightening, prakashakam. So if you have two people in the mode of goodness who have a mode match or who just really like each other, it's much more likely that that attraction is based on a real understanding, because in the mode of goodness, they're more clear-headed. They actually understand things. And there's sort of like a direct inverse ratio. You know, the more endorphins, the less objective. And so if someone's like wildly, passionately in love with someone, it's very likely a bad match. Because the person is just basically delirious. It's like a state of delirium. It's like a person that's drunk at a party and falls madly in love in a drunken state, and the next morning looks at the person, oh my God, what did I take home? So, and that's why there's so much trouble in the world. So we have to be very careful. That's why it's good sometimes to take advice from those who are actually not DUI, not intoxicated, not drunk on endorphins. And you know, it's a very serious thing. You have to look. People have histories. You know, some families have histories of mental illness. For example, Jane Eyre, the great novel by Charlotte Bronte, Jane Eyre, where, anyway. So I remember one time I was counseling a devotee lady, girl, young lady, who was sort of, as we say in ISKCON, associating with some guy. We have all this really interesting meta language. And so she was associating with this guy, and then he was from England, and he flew to Los Angeles to spend time with her. And I was, you know, I was telling her, yeah, hopefully it'll work out, but be careful. And then it turned out that his friends in Los Angeles, who'd also come to see, were really strange people. They were not respectable people. And I told her, you know, if this guy has such weird friends, you better really watch out. And of course, it didn't work out. And she realized that you can tell someone, you know, who are their friends and what do people in general think about this person and what kind of family do they come from. These things actually matter. Anyway, that was some free marriage counseling. So, any other question on all these points? Yes?
I'm always confused about where is the point where I can enjoy the things I do for Krishna. Where, because it's really hard not to smell what you are cooking while you're cooking. Or stuff like that.
Prabhupada once said, only eat what you like and it'll be good for you. At what point do we enjoy? There's a difference between enjoying and trying to enjoy. For example, because some people interpret not trying to enjoy as not enjoying. But Krishna says in the Gita, yadrcha labha santushta. You should be satisfied, fully satisfied, with gain which comes of its own accord. For example, if I just walk into a plate of nice prasadam, you know, I didn't plan it, it happened. And let's say you eat the prasadam, and you're not trying to enjoy, you're just relishing it. Because even, you know that verse, Chaturvidasri Bhagavat Prasada Swadvana Triptan. Hari Bhakti Sangha. The Guru was satisfying seeing the devotees Swadvana Tripta, satisfied by really tasty prasadam. So if the Guru sees that you're really satisfied because you had some tasty prasadam, not like the Guru, you know, holds up a red card or something and you just did something really bad. So it makes Krishna happy. It makes Prabhupada happy to see that we are relishing tasty prasadam. I mean, obviously, you can go to the other extreme. You know, one can't simply get into what I call varaha bhava, you know, the mood of a pig. So devotee, if you eat prasadam and with that consciousness that I'm just trying to get some energy for serving Krishna, and this is Krishna's prasadam. And then it's really tasty. You really enjoy it. I mean, you're supposed to really enjoy it. So again, the distinction between enjoying and trying to enjoy. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, it would be this absurd situation where the soul is by nature blissful, but you can never actually experience your nature. So you have to constantly repress your own nature and not be blissful, because that would be sense gratification. Which is obviously absurd. So really it's about the intention, not the experience itself. Mm-hmm. A devotee, Prabhupada once said, if you're not in Krishna consciousness, if you're not happy, you're doing something wrong. So being miserable is not a sign of being a serious devotee. One time I was in L.A. with Prabhupada, and I gave the Bhagavatam class. Prabhupada was, of course, upstairs in his room. And somehow or other, I was giving the class, and it came out. There were a lot of funny things in the class. I didn't plan it that way. And devotees were laughing. And so then I was actually thinking, I wonder if I should, you know, be funny in class. Is that really right? So, I had that thought in my mind. I walked up to see Prabhupada, and as soon as I walked in the door, the first thing Prabhupada said was, "This is very nice. Keep the devotees jolly." And so I guess Prabhupada heard the laughter from me. You could hear everyone laughing. So he must have asked his secretary who's giving class. Prabhupada, for example, there's that famous story from Leelamrita in the early days in San Francisco when the devotees went to Stinson Beach, north of San Francisco, and Prabhupada was so happy just seeing his disciples playing in the water, you know, water sports. And he was really happy. I mean, any mother, any father is happy to see their children happy. So to be a devotee, even to be a pure devotee, doesn't mean to be unnatural. For example, just as there's a difference between enjoying and trying to enjoy, so there's a difference between making a plan to exploit Krishna, like, I'm going to worship Krishna, I want this and I want that. One time I was staying with a nice devotee, a very nice devotee, but on the wall of his office, he had a picture of this very expensive luxury car, luxury sports car, and he said, what's that? And so he was doing some kind of course on positive thinking, and you have to meditate on what you want. So I was thinking, okay. But like, for example, consider the residents of Vrindavan. They're obviously pure devotees. I mean, the residents of Vrindavan, Krishna was here. They're obviously pure devotees, and yet certain events happened that were so shocking that they cried out to Krishna for help. That's not karmakanda. That's not trying to get benefits from Krishna. It's just a spontaneous crying out to Krishna when there's nothing else you can do. When there's a forest fire, when demons attacked, when Indra sent storms, the residents would just cry out to Krishna for help. And these are pure devotees, and yet some events are just so shocking that it would be unnatural, it would be almost insane not to cry out for help. So we can't be fanatical in that sense. So any other question? We'll talk about that after the class. I was just making the simple point that as far as I read the Bhagavatam, I don't see that it was a custom in Vedic culture, as we say, to do that. When people address women, they often do something really shocking. They actually call them by their names. And there actually are some people actually have names. There are people, also there are certain terms that are used when they, like respectful terms toward women, but it's not Mataji, it's, for example, Padre, from the word Padra, which means noble lady, or Shubhe, fine lady, or something like that. I understand, I know that Chanakya Pandit said that that you should see other people's wives actually, he said other people's wives as mother. He didn't say to call them mother, he just said to see them that way. And Prabhupada, of course, didn't always use this custom. It's just to give my view, and it's just my view, that the strategy is obvious. The idea is that it's based on a belief that men and women are so inclined to fall down with each other that one has to erect these incest taboos between men and women. Because obviously, perhaps the most like vulgar form of incest would be between a mother and her son. And so therefore, it's to like put this incest taboo up to... Of course, it doesn't really work very well, as we know from the history of the Hare Krishna movement. But still, it's not something which is... Chanakya is not scripture. It's just Chanakya. And so that's my view. I tend to follow the Bhagavatam rather than Chanakya. Yes?
So, the Krishna consciousness, we actually do service to please the guru, to please the devotees, and then we can make advancements. So, but then I was wondering, if you go, you depend on all this pleasing, then what about you just get like hooked by, oh, they have to be happy with me, instead of like doing it from a sense of
helping. Yeah, that's a real danger. That's a real danger because in every human community or society, every human community society rewards certain types of favorable behavior and punishes certain types of behavior they don't like, either by actual physical punishment or jail or simply by ignoring someone or criticizing someone. And so we can definitely become addicted to rewards and punishments. And someone can be in a spiritual society and almost everything they do is just to get rewards and avoid punishments. Yes, and that's what Lord Chaitanya referred to as weeds growing in the garden. If we're doing devotional service just to get rewards, I want everyone to love me, I want people to praise me, then of course it just becomes a mundane psychology. It is hard to avoid, but I think, for example, what I'm doing in my life, trying to, it's not so much that I'm trying to please. I mean, trying to please Prabhupada. Let's say I'm trying to please Prabhupada. That doesn't mean that I want Prabhupada to be pleased with me. There's a difference between saying I want him to be pleased with me and I just want to please him. They're not the same thing. So, in fact, that's what Krishna says. I was explaining yesterday, charity or giving, we have the word donation, that Sanskrit dana, donation. And so, in the mode of goodness, we give, or we offer. Like, I mean, charity is literally, charity means something which is given to someone less fortunate than ourselves. So when you give down, it's charity. When you give up, it's called sacrifice. So in the same way, Krishna says, yashtavyam iti jagyan, that we offer because it's the right thing to do. We offer a service to Krishna. So, no, in clear consciousness, we don't want someone to be pleased with us. We want them to be pleased. And so those are different things. You have to check your own motivations. Is it that I want that person to be pleased, or I want them to be pleased with me? Yeah, and also, just a quick reference, I explained also yesterday about Socrates, that the gods love certain actions because they're good. It's not that, I don't see Prabhupada as just sort of, you know, whimsically enjoying certain things. So, like, okay, my guru really loves chocolate bonbons and vanilla ice cream. It's what Prabhupada wants is rational. Prabhupada wants what's best for the world. So there's no difference between Prabhupada's pleasure and what is objectively, historically, best for the world. It's not just trying to somehow or other elicit a positive emotion in Prabhupada. It's understanding that Prabhupada is completely objective, rational, pure, Krishna conscious, and Prabhupada wants certain things because those things are the best things. That's why he wants them. So therefore, I want to please Prabhupada in the sense that I want the best things for the world. And it's not about me, it's about the world. Like I said, I think we really have to reduce a little bit all the talk that I hear constantly of people telling me, devotees, like what they like and what they don't like, and this makes them feel good and that doesn't make them feel good. You know, that's, and it's on a superficial level, you know, just about superficial things. Like external culture and all that. And I think, you know, the Vaishnava is supposed to be Vanchakalpa Tarubya. Vanchakalpa Taru, desire trees, Kripa Sindhu, ocean of mercy. You don't expect an ocean of mercy to be constantly talking about, you know, what makes them comfortable, what they like. For example, Julius Caesar. Bhakta Julie. I won't go into the whole. He's a very interesting figure, Julius Caesar. I could tell some interesting stories about him. But anyway, he was a soldier, in the sense that he actually made his fame in Gaul, which is now France and parts of Western Germany, and even this, actually Belgium too. And for example, when his men obviously were camping out, they're always on these campaigns, military campaigns. He would sleep with them. He didn't get, you know, a lot of luxury. He would eat the same food they did. If they had to dig a trench, which they did all the time, he would be out there digging also. And so he had this absolute loyalty of his men. Absolute loyalty. Because, and he was courageous. There's one story, actually, it's told that in the journals of Julius Caesar, that they were fighting against these huge Germanic tribes. You may have seen these Hollywood movies about these wild Germanic tribes, like painted blue and screaming and naked and everything. But when you read the history, you find out it was actually like that. So it was actually like that. So they were fighting like these, and the Germans, even today, were generally a little bigger than the Italians. And so So they're fighting this battle, and there's a certain point in a military contest where, or a fight, any kind of fight, where one person kind of starts to lose their nerve, and then that's, you know, then it's really over. And so Caesar's troops started to run, and he was so angry, you know, he's telling them, stop, go back. They wouldn't, so he went right to the front line, and he had one injured arm, so all he has one good arm. He took his shield and started bashing these enemy soldiers with his shield. And of course, when his troops saw what he was doing, they all rushed in also. And then they won the battle. So that, you know, soldier, soldier. We have to be a preacher's preacher. We have to, again, Prabhupada is not whimsical. Prabhupada is not just simply some, you know, Epicurean guru that has this taste and that taste, and we have to please his taste. And then we want him to smile at us so we feel good about ourselves. That all has nothing to do with actually, with real bhakti yoga. You know, it's a ridiculous picture of Prabhupada, and it's a false psychology in ourselves. If we want to talk about what it really means to please Prabhupada, it means understanding that Prabhupada was a pure, rational, objective devotee of Krishna who wanted to save the world. Prabhupada was not some, you know, Epicurean or dilettante that just liked certain dress styles, or he liked this, or he liked that. Prabhupada wanted to get the job done. He wanted to get the job done. And if someone doesn't understand that, really doesn't understand Prabhupada. He wanted to get the job done. And the job was to save the planet. And so what Prabhupada's pleasure is, happens to be, and must be, if he's a pure devotee, the ultimate good for the world. And so when I'm trying to try my best to serve Prabhupada, I don't feel like I'm trying to get a little smile or nod from him, or, did you like this, Prabhupada? Wasn't this a cute little thing I offered you? It's not about that. It's about going out and doing the work and getting the results for Prabhupada. That's what it's about. You know, doing what you have to do to get the job done. I'll give you an example. When I was, I know I'm over time. Okay, I'll go another minute or two, and then If I go 10 more minutes, then I lose breakfast. I understand that. So I remember when I started the Spanish BBT, and we started printing books, and Prabhupada was very pleased, and so we were doing the Bhagavatam. And all the BBT trustees told me that, the other trustees, I was also a trustee, that Prabhupada said that you cannot print a soft cover Bhagavatam. You have to do it hardcover. And I thought, well, this is Latin America. People can't afford a hardcover Bhagavatam. So I printed a softcover. And then I told Prabhupada, and he said, yeah, that's great. And he loved the idea. So Prabhupada was, that's the real mission. And back in those days, the women were doing equal service. Back in the days when we, you know, unleashed these ferocious Sankirtan parties on the world. And, you know, fruitive workers were not safe anywhere, not in their homes, not in bars, not on the street. There was no shelter. There was no safe haven from the... Anyway, so I remember back in those days, you know, the men and women were equal in the sense of their service to Prabhupada. So we need courage, determination. You know, the age that we cannot be selfish, we cannot be self-indulgent. We can't spend the rest of our lives, just dancing around the mental platform. You know, the same bad movies in our head. Actually, if someone wants to get out the mental platform and be happy, you have to get out there and be Prabhupada's soldier. Prabhupada said, as if in military discipline. That's the price you have to pay if you want to become a great devotee. If you actually want to experience liberation this lifetime, you earn it. You earn it. By going out and being Prabhupada's soldier. Prabhupada gave his life for us. He traveled around, he endured, you know, diseases and exhaustion at an advanced age. So, you know, ISKCON went through sort of three stages, or it actually has to go to third stage. There was a stage of immature enthusiasm, and then a stage of mature dullness. And, you know, now we have to come to the point of mature enthusiasm. In the early days of the movement, we were like wildly enthusiastic, and we were also just wild in general. And then everybody became mature and no one wanted to, you know, it just sort of went to the other extreme. What we need is to be mature, healthy. One, you know, we have to keep ourselves healthy physically, mentally, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually healthy. But at the same time, we have to get out and actually fight for Prabhupada and grow the Western Hare Krishna movement. That's what Prabhupada actually needs. And that's, it's obvious that's what Prabhupada needs, because the success of his whole international strategy depends upon the success of the movement in the West, as he told me many times. So, if you want to be happy, that's how to make Prabhupada happy. Do what's best for the world. So, thank you very much. Prabhupada ki jai.